Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Methuen, then Kingston and Plymouth.
55 families in need arriving at a Days Inn and bringing far more questions than answers along with them.
Sound there from NBC 10 Boston, talking about the specific Methuen case. The state is sending families to hotels and motels in area communities with little or no advance notice. And we want to understand what's going on here. So joining us on the line, Methuen Mayor Neil Perry. Mayor Perry, I know you're out and about today. Little background noise, which is fine. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that background noise. I'll apologize in advance.
No worries.
I can't go away from it.
No, it's great to have you. So I want to start, Mr. Mayor, by asking you, how did you find out that this group of families had arrived at the Days Inn?
Well, and that's one of my main points of contention with how the state handled this. I actually was on my way to a high school football game, and a local individual who's very active in a nonprofit that works with our underprivileged and low-income folks in the city called me and said she had been called by two state agencies and asked if they could go over to the Days Inn Hotel on Pelham Street in Methuen and help those folks apply for SNAP food benefits and other things, and then help them get enrolled in Methuen Public Schools. So she called me. That's Friday night. I immediately dispatched two of my health and human service individuals over to the hotel, and they confirmed that we did have, and at the time, we didn't even know the number of folks, right? So we now know it's 55 families, 86 adults, and 130 children, of whom 72 are school age. But when my team got over there, they found that the families hadn't eaten in more than a day. So I called a local restaurant owner, John Vargas from Bada Bing, who's so good to our city, and I told him my situation, and he said, man, don't worry about the cost. We'll talk about that later. And he got pizza and pasta over there in an hour, and we took $750 of our Methuen Cares initiative, which is for our needy folks in our community, and we took $750 of grocery gift certificates to Market Basket, went and shopped and got things that could stay in a hotel room. And our two individuals shopped and brought that over there Friday night to get them fed, and then reached out to express my outrage with the state.
So a scrambled response there, Mayor Perry. I wonder, was the arrival of the families unusual, the lack of notice from the state unusual, or both?
Yeah. So, great question. Both, really. And what it comes down to, this is not the first time the state has done it to the city of Methuen. So during the pandemic, the state put homeless individuals in the same hotel without so much as a courtesy call to Methuen. And so that's, I want to be crystal clear. My frustration is not with the individuals. My frustration is with the state. This is the second time they've done this. And quite frankly, I don't get support from DHCD, which is the state organization that did this, for the homeless in my community. I have homeless in my community today that I'm struggling with, and I'm going to be quite crystal clear. I'm very perturbed that they allowed National Grid and Eversource to up their rates, because my senior community is struggling, and that's going to negatively impact that. So we've taken $400,000 out of our ARPA budget. We've set it aside to help our seniors, because in a community like this, nobody should have to choose between heat, food, or shelter over their head during a tough winter. And those rate increases are going to be terrible.
I'm assuming so. A couple things there. And again, we're speaking with Methuen Mayor Neil Perry here. First, DHCD is the Department of Housing and Community Development. They are obligated to provide shelter or housing for all families with children under age 21 and pregnant people. Sure. And I'm assuming when you're worried about that $400,000, it is in part because having set it aside for older adults for utility bills, it's not available to help, for example, now the 55 families that you find yourself with at the Days Inn.
Correct. Exactly correct. And great point. And not only that, so as we got into it, and I'm going to be crystal clear. So the DHCD still has not, worked with the city to get down to the level of the number of children you know, there's multiple languages. There's folks that speak Creole from Haiti. There's Venezuelans, there's Dominicans, and there's people that have been in other Massachusetts communities. And so that's, you know, the frustrating part, because legally we have to put school-age children in the Methuen public schools. That's where the primary issue of funding is going to occur, because we don't have a Creole curriculum in our Methuen public schools. So how do we serve these people who are just literally parachuted into the community without any advance notice? And that's the frustration.
I think I was about to ask what you're about to say, which is, I understand since then you have spoken with the Department of Housing and Community Development. They've made, they've had statements to you, and as well with subsequent stories that we'll bring up in a minute about Kingston and Plymouth. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is correct. So, but I want to be honest here. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm not happy with the DHCD response. So we had a meeting with them last Thursday where, let's talk about the human element here, right? These people, they've been parachuted into the community. They don't understand. They don't know where they are. They don't, know all about the community. And so that's difficult for anybody. We went over to the hotel Tuesday night, myself, the fire chief, the police chief, one of the city councilors who speaks Creole, thank God. And we talked to the individuals. We found out some of these have been relocated multiple times, hotel to hotel, without anybody from the state talking to them or telling them what the plan is. And that's the frustrating part. So I ended up talking to the lieutenant governor after the meeting with DHCD, because they still don't have a plan, right? It's not, we're over a week later. We had the meeting last Thursday with DHCD, and still there's no plan. They're just saying, well, they might be there through the end of the year.
Although DHCD is
not a good plan.
Although DHCD is being clear, Mr. Mayor, that they will provide for housing and food because that's their responsibility in relationship to the families that are there. Is that correct?
Sure. But, housing is, I guess I'd ask you, is housing staying in the hotel till the end of the year? Because that's not, to me, that's not an appropriate place for families like this. And I can tell you, the housing market in City Methuen is difficult as it is. And I've got, my main issue is I've got homeless that I'm struggling to take care of now who are already in the city, right? So that's the difficulty here. It's not about the people. They're lovely people. We went over and talked to them. And they're as frustrated as I am because nobody's talked to them about what the plan would be, right? And so, as I said earlier, some of them told me that they've been relocated hotel to hotel to hotel across Massachusetts multiple times, and nobody from the state's even gone out to talk to them.
All right. Methuen Mayor Neil Perry there joining us from out on the road. Mayor Perry, thank you so much. I appreciate you touching bases.
No problem.
I'm going to bring in another voice now, Boston Herald columnist Joe Battenfeld, who's been writing on this subject, heard that part of the conversation, joins us now. Joe, welcome.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Glad to have you. Let me just start with your reactions to what we just heard from Methuen Mayor Neil Perry.
I mean, you can just hear the frustration in the mayor's voice, and I don't blame him at all. Getting just no warning at all that these families were coming. And they're expected hungry, not having eaten for a day. How is that happening when the state is supposed to be providing food and shelter? There are a lot of questions here. Now Kingston and Plymouth are dealing with the same thing again with no warning at all. And that's my issue really, is this lack of transparency with the state and treating this issue as just like something. It's a humanitarian and housing crisis, really. It's more than just immigration. This is really a humanitarian crisis that's going on, and the state seems to be contributing to it by just shuttling off people from hotel to hotel without any plan of how to get them assimilated into the towns.
So, Joe, I actually first became aware of the story in Methuen after reading your column on it. And as you referenced, I'm going to dive into this a little bit more. We've had some subsequent instances. First, Kingston, some 107 people have arrived there. They're being housed at the Baymont by Wyndham Hotel. Here's a little sound about that.
We are now told that those people, including children, are being housed here at this hotel behind me. And the town administrator says they were brought here totally unannounced.
That's WCVB, and Kingston Town Administrator Keith Hickey says the town wasn't aware. The Boston Globe now reporting Plymouth Town Manager Derek Brindisi says he's been notified just yesterday that the town will receive 27 families. You heard me ask the mayor of Methuen, Joe, is it the arrival of the families, is it the lack of notice, or both? And he said both. We know that hotels and motels are the choice of last resort for the state. We also know that this practice of housing people in hotels and motels has been going on for a long time because of the requirements in the state. What feels profoundly different to you here, Joe?
Well, it just seems like there's a lack of compassion here for the people, these families that are involved. You know, there's a great stigma to being homeless and to living in a hotel. And by their silence, by the state's silence and the governor's silence, you know, they're in some cases they're telling people, the families, not to talk to the media. You know, they're really it's adding to the stigma of the whole situation. And like I said, this is more than just about immigration. This is really a housing crisis that we're dealing with, and the state needs to the lack of planning to me is the most egregious thing, that they don't have a plan to get these kids into school and to teach them in their language. And, you know, if food, basic things like, you know, eating dinner, they haven't eaten for a day, that just strikes me as totally wrong.
So have you heard back from Governor Baker's administration or the Department of Housing and Community Development, Joe, since you wrote your piece?
They send out these, you know, statements without any attribution. They're just a background statement saying, well, they are acknowledging they're sending people to these hotels, and that's their obligation to take care to do that. But there's no explanation as to why they were not given advance warning and why they're treating it like that. And, you know, this is something the governor needs to address, I think. Really, you heard the mayor say he talked to the lieutenant governor about this because he was so upset about it. This is something the governor needs to address, I believe.
So I want to break this down a little bit more, Joe, and kind of take the opportunity to use your wisdom from over the years. So we know that there's something both new and not new here. And two thoughts occurred to me when I first read your piece. Part of what struck me about it is that we are so sensitive right now after the arrival of the families on Martha's Vineyards who were allegedly tricked essentially into coming. We know Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has claimed responsibility for that. This no notice thing has taken on a new political patina. Oh, and I do want to note, we did reach out, by the way, to the governor's office and DHCD, left messages, did not hear back from either of them in time for this segment. Are we hyper aware of something here, Joe, that's been going on? Or are we more in a situation here where our housing need is so bad, right? You know, Methuen, where we were just talking about 55 families being there, rents over $2,000, the average home price is over $500,000. Are we more hyper aware, or are we in a different kind of crisis? Do you understand what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I do think there is a political tint to some of this, that, you know, that DeSantis injected himself into this and is trying to use this for political gain. And, you know, so there definitely is that aspect to it. But like I said, this is primarily a housing crisis that we've got in Massachusetts right now, I feel anyway, and that the lack of housing and affordable housing is going on everywhere across the state, not just in Methuen. And these towns like Methuen are trying their best to deal with it, but they don't have the resources to deal with it, and they don't have the inventory, housing inventory of affordable housing. So something's got to give here.
Joe, we have an election coming up, and the first Tuesday in November. We've had a number of issues. We'll be electing a new governor for the first time in three cycles. Do you see this, the emergence and awareness of this situation with the state? And again, for listeners, we are talking about the arrival of families, often migrant families, but not always, to cities and towns, including Methuen, Kingston, and Plymouth, into hotels and motels to provide them housing without advance notice or what the towns would say is sufficient planning for how the families will be cared for, educated for their children, et cetera. Does this change the agenda and the conversation going into the governor's election that Tuesday, Joe? And does it change what we need to expect from the next elected governor coming out of that?
It should. I mean, Maura Healey should be addressing this right now. Her opponent, Jeff Diehl, had just put out a statement, you know, saying, trying to take advantage of the situation, basically, and saying it's because of an immigration crisis that this is going on. But that's not really just the whole story of it. You know, so I think it's be a good opportunity for Maura Healey, who's probably going to be the next governor, and she's going to be, you know, have to deal with this problem going on, and that she's going to be taking office in the middle of winter. And this situation is just going to get worse as people get shuttled from hotel to hotel. So she needs to come up with a plan, I think, a long-term plan to help these families.
And again, I want to underscore the DHCD policy by law is to provide housing to families with children under 21 or pregnant people, regardless of whether they come through migrant or immigration or our local families. That is not sort of the emphasis of what we're doing here. And hotels and motels are the option of last resort. So last question to you, Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald. What are you watching for next on this story?
I'd like to have the governor address this situation and, you know, come up with a plan to help these families and to actually cooperate with the towns that they're sending people to. And so I think they could make a good start of things by just having an open conversation with these towns and coming up with a reasonable plan to get these kids in school and to get them fed and to find longer term housing. And, you know, I think it's, like I said before, it's a perfect opportunity for Maura Healey to step in now and weigh in on the situation.
All right. Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And it is time for another installment of Brilliant Boston, where we bring you some of the most popular classes at the region's universities. Last time, we heard from a Wellesley professor about a class on philosophy and witchcraft. Sticking with the season, here's what we have for you today.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
It was alive. Monsters, of course. That's Colin Clive there as Dr. Frankenstein in the 1931 classic about his monster. You know the story. But did you know that the stories we tell ourselves about monsters reflect what we're most afraid of in real life? So with Frankenstein, for example, technology. Todd Avery is a professor at UMass Lowell, and he teaches monsters, apes, and nightmares, and joins us for this latest edition of Brilliant Boston. Todd, welcome.
Tatiana, thank you very much.
You were kind of cracking up during that sound.
I love that. It's one of the fantastic scenes in all of movies.
And it was alive, and that means a lot, right? You pick Frankenstein as part of this course because there's so much packed into it, Todd.
Yeah, I do. In fact, originally this course was called Frankenstein's Monsters, and that evolved over time. But it began with a focus on Frankenstein, which is a novel that I actually wrote my undergraduate English thesis on. Then I went to graduate school fully intending to study Mary Shelley more and the romantic.
Who wrote Frankenstein for people. Yeah.
Exactly. And somehow I ended up getting sucked into a 19th century vortex and spit out on the other end. But and so I really specialized in late 19th century and early 20th century literature. But I've always been fascinated by Frankenstein, and one of the reasons is that it really it creates it's the beginning of science fiction, and so we can think of Mary Shelley as the mother of science fiction. For a long time, the fathers of science fiction were often referred to from the late 19th century, included H.G. Wells, in the slightly earlier, Jules Verne, the French writer. But Mary Shelley was really the mother of science fiction, and she gave us a fundamental modern myth in the story of the mad scientist who wants to play God, using modern science and technology, but fails to imagine the potential negative consequences of his act.
All right, so I'm going to use that thrill right there, fails to imagine the consequences of his act, to bring in another story that you use in your class. Here's a little bit of tape.
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think if they should.
Of course, that's Jurassic Park, 1993. You're hearing Richard Attenborough as John Hammond, Jeff Goldblum as Ian Malcolm, who's the chaos theory expert of now, sort of pop culture legend. The book written by Michael Crichton, another set of monsters, although monsters that we also love, with a warning about our relationship with technology.
You beat me to that quote,
oh,
too.
No.
I was going to quote that wonderful line from Ian Malcolm. Yeah, Jurassic Park. I mean, one of the things that we love about Jurassic Park is it has dinosaurs. It's just so cool, right? But Jurassic Park is a fascinating novel. I think it's probably Michael Crichton's best novel. But regardless of that, it's a fascinating novel in how it can be seen as one of Mary Shelley's sort of hideous progeny. That's the way she described her own book. She described Frankenstein as her hideous progeny, her monstrous child. But in creating that hideous progeny, she set a form, like I said, for a lot of science fiction to come. And Michael Crichton is clearly aware of the history of science fiction as a particular kind of science fiction that's a cautionary tale. And he's working sort of just right in that Frankenstein line, which, you know, you go back to Frankenstein, and we're talking about a scientist who harnesses the latest in electrical and other scientific, chemical, mathematical, physical developments.
Of that time.
Galvanic batteries, for instance, were kind of all the rage during the time when Mary Shelley was writing her story. And so electricity was always a key component of it. But Mary Shelley created this story about essentially the do not go into that cave, that there's certain kinds of illicit knowledge, things that we're not meant to know. And she also created the idea of the scientist as the person who is illicitly kind of manipulating the natural world.
Supplanting God.
Victor Frankenstein, at one key moment in recounting his story, says that wealth was an inferior object, but what glory would attend the discovery if I could banish disease from the human frame and render man invulnerable to any but a violent death? And the way he's going to do this is to create a new kind of species.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, a new species would bless me. He uses this religious language. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. And so Victor Frankenstein really sees himself as playing God. Now, if you take the Frankenstein story, and this, I should say the subtitle of Frankenstein is The Modern Prometheus.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary Shelley is referring back to the myth of Prometheus, who does two things. He actually is a creator titan who comes to Earth and literally molds and shapes human beings out of the earth and breathes life into us.
And I know the second thing he does.
Yes.
He steals fire from the gods.
So he's a creator. He also wants to be a benefactor. He wants to help humanity. Using technology, by giving us fire, and he pays a dear price for it.
Which is the gods punish him by forcing him to. Is he the one that's chained to a rock?
He's chained to a mountain.
And every day a bird comes and eats out his internal organs, and then it repeats the next day. It's pretty bad.
It's very, very bad. Can't imagine.
Yeah. All right. So there's a whole bunch of threads I want to pick up on there.
So finish
that thought, and let me jump into a couple of these threads.
Okay. So I'll do it very, very quickly. If you take Frankenstein. Add The Island of Dr. Moreau, the 1896 novel by H.G. Wells, which also involves a mad scientist trying to sort of playing God and seeing himself as a Prometheus plasticator, a shaper, a molder, a sculptor.
He makes strange creatures.
And he says that his goal was to discover his lifelong scientific goal was to discover the extreme limits of plasticity in a living shape. Hmm. But where Dr. Moreau does his work is on an island off the coast of South America. And so you can see where I'm going with this. And those of you who know who know Jurassic Park know where I'm going with this. If you take Frankenstein and then add the island of Dr. Moreau and then throw in late 20th century genetic engineering and the coolest creatures ever, dinosaurs, you end up with Jurassic Park. Off the coast of South America on an island.
Yeah.
All involving scientists doing illicit things. You'd have to, for Jurassic Park, you'd also have to throw in the economic motive of theme park profit.
So we're speaking with Todd Avery, who's a professor at UMass Lowell. This is our Brilliant Boston segment where we bring you one of the most popular classes at one of our area universities, and his is Monsters, Apes, and Nightmares, which tells us the stories that we tell ourselves are really about the things we fear most. So there are a couple of things I want to ask here. One, as you've pointed out, as the technology changes, electricity versus genetic engineering for genetic manipulation, the type of monster changes, right? A new species made out of electricity in Frankenstein, an old species brought back to life using genetic engineering in Jurassic Park. We are a hub of technology here. Yep. I mean, I can think of the number of conversations just in the last 3 months I've had about the bio science that's happening in Kendall Square. Do we tell any of the stories here? You know, we're bringing forth the things that make people want to tell monster stories. Does this region tell the monster stories too? Or are these authors from other places? You know, I'm curious about that.
There's a wonderful young adult novel that tells a kind of monster story published back around 2002, I think it was, by M.T. Anderson, who lives in Cambridge and is a National Book Award winner. He wrote a novel called Feed, which is a futuristic, a dystopian novel in which all of the characters are implanted with a chip into their brain. And what that enables, so that's the feed, what it enables is them to receive messages from the feed net 24/7.
Oh, man.
And so this is
it's a little 1984. Almost.
It is a little bit 1984, but it's also the age of social media.
Yeah.
He also includes nanotechnology, for instance. And I know there's a lot of nanotechnology research happening here. I think there's still a collaboration between Northeastern and UMass Lowell and the University of New Hampshire on this. So yes, Anderson writes this novel as, again, a kind of a cautionary tale about how profit motive can sort of, in a sense, hijack potentially beneficial scientific developments. And also, he's writing a kind of critique of emergent social media.
So you feel there's no accident, as I understand it, that this is a course that can be taught at UMass Lowell specifically. And this is fascinating.
Yeah.
Tell this.
Yeah. So the title of the course, Monsters, Apes, and Nightmares, which forms a wonderful acronym, MAN. I know it's a little gender specific, but I'll work on that. The title is really the kind of rhetorical sugarcoating on the intellectual pill of the course. It's the catch. It's the hook. What the class really is an opportunity for students from all disciplines and majors to read literary representations and dramatizations of science and technology. Mm. I ask them to do this as a way, so to speak, of bridging the two cultures.
The famous humanities two and cultures. The science and technology.
Yes, exactly. Of the humanities and the sciences that the British scientist and novelist C.P. Snow wrote about 60 years ago in his book, The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution. And so, I mean, the thing about courses is that they're all taught, they all happen in a particular place and at a particular time. And obviously, the time is the present. And I teach this course, I teach this course online. But I also teach it on ground or in an earthbound format at UMass Lowell. And UMass Lowell, geographically, in terms of place, is fascinating because it is a perfect geographical metaphor, the campus itself, a perfect geographical metaphor of the two cultures. We have two campuses. Well, one campus now, but One of them began in the 1890s. It was founded as the Lowell Technological Institute, mm-hmm. and its purpose was to train engineers to run the mills in Lowell and to forward the industrial, as some people called it, revolution. The other campus started as the Lowell Normal School, which was a teaching school for young women to go and learn how to teach the growing numbers of immigrant children and children migrating in from the countryside and children of the people working in the mills and contributing to the overall economy of Lowell. So over time, UMass Lowell has been through different permutations, but now it's UMass Lowell. We have two campuses connected by two physical bridges, but I thought maybe a course that invited students to, so to speak, bridge the two cultures by reading literature about science and by asking them also to bring their own disciplinary expertise to bear on some pressing, urgent questions.
And it sounds like you're doing that. All right. That is Todd Avery, professor at UMass Lowell, instructor of the popular class Monsters, Apes, and Nightmares. It's our latest installation of Brilliant Boston. Next month's installment, we'll talk all about music made out of brain waves. Todd, thank you so much for joining us.
Tiziana, thank you so much. And could I also just very, very briefly give a shout out to both my online and on-ground students, many of whom I think are listening today. They're the reason for this class.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for listening. Okay, so I got my bucket of popcorn here. I brought a soda in that I'm going to crack right now. I have done my homework. I've seen the Friends of Eddie Coyle, and I am very excited because we are launching a new segment today where you learn and hopefully watch along with us. It's called Set in Boston, where movie critics teach us about films set or made in Boston. So did you do your homework? Did you watch The Friends of Eddie Coyle? And if you didn't, don't worry. We're still going to learn a ton because with us here in Studio 2, two people who totally do their homework when it comes to films. Ty Burr is the creator of the Substack e-newsletter Ty Burr's Watch List, and Allison Johnson is the editor-in-chief at theyoungfolks.com and film critic at cambridgedaily.com. Ty, welcome back.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Allie, welcome.
Thank you.
Are you guys popcorn eaters? Can I pour some out for you here?
We were just talking about, I'm actually the movie critic who doesn't like popcorn.
You don't like popcorn. Okay,
and everywhere I go, people say, you're a movie critic, here's some popcorn.
Thank you.
I want you to know popcorn is sacred food in my family.
Okay.
It's got butter on it and everything. All right, so Ty.
I'm a junior mints guy. What can I tell
you?
Oh,
yes. I'm fully in support of that, okay, actually. Good. All right. So when we approached you about doing Set in Boston, you said we should start with the film The Friends of Eddie Coyle. And I will admit, when I watched it, two things at the same time, I thought, okay, I get it. And I also thought, why? So tell us, why did we start with The Friends of Eddie Coyle?
Because it is the first Boston crime movie and the template for everything that followed. Really, it took a couple of decade or two to kick in. But all of the movies that people think of as Boston movies, especially everybody in the rest of the country, and I'm thinking Mystic River, and I'm thinking Gone Baby Gone, and The Town, and The Departed, or The Departed, or however you want to say it, they all have their roots in The Friends of Eddie Coyle, and not just the movie, we can talk about that in a bit, but the characters, the attitude, the locations, it's all there in this one movie.
And it came from a book.
Yes. It was came from a book written by George V. Higgins, who was a criminal attorney in the, I believe, the state's attorney office, and knew these people, and wrote a number of books, some of which have been turned into movies. Friends of Eddie Coyle was his first. And his books, they're remarkable reading. They're 90% dialogue, and they're, I think, Allie, you put it best when we were talking. You said, you know, it was brutal.
Yeah, it's a really lean movie, and mm-hmm. it's sad and tragic, and I feel like it just gets this realism with people in the area. I just think there's a humanity in how, you know, swiftly everything just goes downhill.
Yeah.
You know, they don't play it out.
All right, so let's talk through the plot just a little bit for people. And Allie, I'll stay with you for a minute. So, you know, the Friends of is facetious, clearly,
yes.
because Eddie Coyle very quickly, played by Robert Mitchum, it becomes very clear this is a friendless guy, a guy who's living on the margins of society, using crime to try to make a living. It clearly doesn't pay that well. And there's a sense from the beginning, I think, Allie, that this is just not going to end well.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there's that impending sense of doom. And even though it's kind of a small scale, you know, it's always just a very personal relationships. It's never going to be this huge, you know, shootout that happens with people, but it's just the continual being let down by people he thinks he's friends with. And I think that's what makes it more tragic, too, is I think he doesn't realize he's friendless. It's more that everybody else knows that he's replaceable and expendable. But yeah, no, I think from the opening moments and just the way that Robert Mitchum plays him as so tired and world-weary, it's you get the feeling he's not going to have a happy end.
So let's talk a little bit about the casting and that what's the word I'm looking for? Patina of this movie, Ty. So I'm going to play a little bit of sound here. We just talked about Robert Mitchum plays Eddie Coyle. And Bart Tacci, our producer, could not help but sort of grade accents as part of the acting
of course,
we went along. So he picked a cut here that we can hear that with. Here we go.
Count as many as you want. As many as you got, I got four more. You know how I got those? I bought some stuff from a man. I knew his name. The stuff was traced. The guy I bought it for, he's at MCI Walpole for 15 to 25, still in there. But he had some friends. I got an extra set of knuckles.
And just for context, he gets an extra set of knuckles because the people who are upset about the guy winding up in MCI Walpole kick his hand closed in a drawer and it
right.
breaks his fingers and he's got these extra knuckles. So yeah. First, what's your grade on the accent, Ty?
Honestly, I think Mitchum does a really good job in part because he doesn't push it. He wears it very, very lightly. You only hear it in certain words. He's not, you know, as you mentioned, grading Boston accents in movies. It's a spectator sport in this area. And we all have our worst offenders Kevin Costner and JFK.
I mean, sorry.
That's quite all right. Rob Morrow and what's the movie he's in? I forget the name of it, but it's just that's the worst. Absolutely.
Yeah, I can't remember the movie, but I still actually remember how bad Rob Morrow's accent was in it. So.
I think it's once around. I think Mitchum does a credible job. There are other people in the film. Richard Jordan, a fine, fine actor who's no longer with us, who plays his connection in the. His government, his cop connection.
Yeah.
Who's trying to get him to turn on his friends. He overdoes the accent. He's a good actor, but Laura Linney once told me when I interviewed her, she said when an actor, and it was after Mystic River, she said when an actor hears that they have to do either a South African accent or a Boston accent, a chill goes up their spine. It's not easy.
So Laura Linney, by the way, now most well-known, I think, for our viewers, our listeners from Ozark.
Ozark,
right,
correct.
Right. So, Allie, I'll turn back to you for a minute. Robert Mitchum is a rough and tumble, pleasant-looking but craggy guy. most of the actors, Peter Boyle, for example, which we did a segment earlier in the show about Frankenstein, he's often well-known as playing Frankenstein's monster in the Mel Brooks movie Young Frankenstein. He's in it. This is a white movie. It's a white guy movie. It's there's a lot of racism, overt racism in the movie. You're a younger film critic whose probably first exposure to Boston films would be stuff from the last 20 years. This is 1973. How did you react to and take in all those pieces of this sort of classic Boston crime film?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it wasn't a film that I had gravitated towards to in the past, kind of for what you said. It's a, not to gender films, but it's a white guy movie. And there's other films out there that I haven't seen yet. But I ended up really liking this one because I think it never condones any of the actions. It's never showing it in a glamorous lifestyle. The whole point of this is how miserable it is. You know, I think there are plenty of films that do glamorize this lifestyle, that do glamorize like the triumph of bad white men who get to live large and on their terms. But in this case, it's a guy on the outskirts. And I think by making him seem so down on his luck and somebody who doesn't even really want to be in any part of what he's doing, you know, I think of the line when he looked at the machine gun and he's like, oh, that looks like a war weapon or something. And there's such a...
And he's a gun trader.
Yeah. And he's so frightened, though, sounding by it. And so I think the fact that we know from the start, like you said, that there's this sense of gloom, it made it easier digestible because there are plenty of films out there where they're not condoning the actions, they're not condoning the racism. It's used just for shock. And so in this case, it's a little bit more easy to take in.
So, to me, this movie is kind of the anti-Scarface There's a machine gun in that movie, and it's glamorized. It's become this meme, you know, for years.
Say hello to my little friend.
Right.
Yeah. So I let's stay there for a minute, Ty. And let me just remind listeners, we're speaking with Ty Burr, who's the creator of the Substack e-newsletter, Ty Burr's Watchlist, and Allison Johnson, who's the editor-in-chief at youngfolks.com and film critic at cambridgedaily.com. This is our first set in Boston, where we'll be working with Ty and Allie to explore films that are set in Boston, that are to represent iconic Boston, et cetera. Ty, you picked The Friends of Eddie Coyle, 1973, stars Robert Mitchum as our first film, because it is the genre setter. So if Die Hard set action movies after it came out, Friends of Eddie Coyle set the Boston crime drama. And we'll interrogate whether that's how Boston should be known in a minute. But first, use it to lay out what are the sort of stereotypical, now almost comical elements of a Boston crime drama.
You know, and to the point where it's now become parody. And I think we saw that there was a parody trailer Boston movie or Boston accent a couple of years
there
ago.
There was one called Boston Accent. There's a New Yorker one about the ever-present script, and there's always an Affleck and a Damon in it. Yeah,
right. And it's always the Affleck you like least. I read that too. That came out this week. The aspects of the Boston crime movie that are laid out in Friends of Eddie Coyle, and really by George V. Higgins, you really have to credit him with it. And the movie sticks extremely closely to the book. The setting, it's not downtown. The one downtown place we see in Friends of Eddie Coyle is Government Center, which at that point was new, and that brutalist architecture it's hardly pretty. But it's deglamorized locations. The Kentucky Tavern on the corner of Mass Ave and Newberry Street no longer exists. The Boston Bowl in Morrissey Boulevard in Dorchester, which still does exist. All these places where people actually live. And location shooting is incredibly important to a Boston crime movie. That sense that you're in neighborhoods where people live, not where they work, where they live, and the bars. And the characters have to not trust each other. I think that's sort of a given in the genre, too, is that there's this low-level paranoia that there is nobody that you can trust. It is a white guy genre, and I think that carries a lot of truth. And the better films acknowledge that in ways subtle and less subtle. And I can talk about those at other times. And there is, I think, a sense of lowering of doom that in this movie is most explicit. But I think in other movies, even when there's a, quote, satisfying ending, a lot of characters don't make it out. That it is a fatalistic genre. Similar to sort of like the gumshoe genre that, you know, Bogart, you know, that James M. Cain.
The P.I.
You know, exactly. Raymond
Chandler
did. The
game walks into his office.
Right.
And, yeah.
But this is a more realistic, gritty, gray version that is a little more true to human nature, the darker side of human nature. And I think those values, those dramatic values, not only show up in George V. Higgins and his great heir, Dennis Lehane, but in the movies made from their works.
So just, you know, Allie, Dennis Lehane, his great heir. Now we are talking Mystic River, Gone Baby Gone. Any Given Day, which is a book. The Town is Lehane. The Town. So all of those, again, in this category, which has become in the public psyche what Boston is. But we're so much more than that, Allie.
Yes, I think so, too.
And do you think that we've limited our imagination in film in how we express who Boston is or in where people go, with the movies people will go see about Boston because of the power of this genre?
I think a little bit. But I think, you know, it's sometimes just down to the nature of limitations of shooting, too. I feel like it might be easier to shoot a crime drama because you can use different kind of sets. But I think it does limit it. I think it's the case also for places like New York a bit, where you just are so assuming of a certain city and how the people are like. I would certainly like to see more. And, you know, there was a TV show recently on AMC that I can't say the full title of because there's a swear. Kevin.
Thank you for not doing
that.
Yeah,
you're welcome. That I thought really showed like the suburbs of the area really truly and honestly. So I think there's room for growth. I think it's just who are you putting behind the camera to tell the stories? You know, is it all white men And are they all gravitating towards stories about white men in these kind of moments of glory or not so? Like, you know, if you diversify maybe who's behind the camera, I feel like we'd get a better output.
Okay, so I want to shift gears now. This is our first set in Boston with Ali Johnson and Ty Burr as we begin to explore films set in Boston, films made in Boston. So I want to now, because we're really looking forward to doing this project with listeners over time, Ty. Mm-hmm. We're going to do other films. So I want to talk a little bit about how to watch films. So the fun one is, what are the prime home viewing conditions for watching a movie?
Okay, and I understand that when a lot of your crew here, your people here watch Friends of Eddie Coyle, it's a 70s movie. It moves slowly. It is slow by current standards.
Yeah.
Ellie was saying, well, you know, it's kind of slam bam, and there's no side plots or anything.
Yeah.
But the way we watch movies at home is, I think, harmful to the movies. Turn off the lights. Put your phone away. Adjust your metabolism to the pace of the movie. Give it your attention. Friends of Eddie Coyle is not going to reward that if you don't lean in a little bit and try and replicate the movie theater experience. And I'm serious. Put your phone away. Put it in a drawer. Don't, you know, listen to it. Turn the sound off. Treat it as a movie in the theater and let it, you know, let it be the movie it wants to be. That's my, you know, my basic advice.
And Ali, what questions do we want? If we want to really engage with a movie, you're a film critic. What are the questions that you hold in your head as you sit down, hopefully in the dark, with your phone away, in more of a theater-oriented experience? What are the questions you want us to ask?
I'm such an emotional watcher of anything, really, where your heart and your sleeve type person. So I think it's about just what do you feel, but also remembering the context of when it was made. I think so many people these days are like, oh, well, that doesn't make sense, or that wouldn't work, or I can see, you know, they think it's sloppy editing or bad acting without realizing the context of the time. And I think kind of learning to love those aspects can make the viewing a lot more interesting. So I think kind of just questioning how you watch movies is the most interesting way to approach them and kind of what you want to get out of them rather than like making it a test for yourself. I think it's more so like, what specific elements did I like and can I apply it to another challenging film that might be a little bit outside of what I would usually go for.
All right. So we have decided that we'd like to kind of try to at least a little bit go back and forth in time with our films. So listeners, for our next set in Boston, we're going to look at a more recent movie that's a crime drama. And we have two options for you, The Town or Gone Baby Gone. And we want to know which one you want. So tweet us at Radio Boston to choose The Town or Gone Baby Gone. Or if you're a member of our texting club, of course, you can text us and let us know. Ty Burr is the creator of the Substack e-newsletter Ty Burr's Watchlist. Allison Johnson is the editor-in-chief at theyoungfolks.com and film critic at cambridgedaily.com. This was fun. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looking forward to doing the next one. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our technical director with help today from Michaela Varela. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.